يا رب.
Okay. Good afternoon. Today, I'd like to talk to you about an overview of measurements for understanding precipitation enhancements. Basically, try to address the question of why we have the instruments on the aircraft here that we do. Maybe something about which ones we don't have that we might like in the future. And give you an overview of the whole process of enhancing precipitation in terms of how we measure the effects of enhancing precipitation. Let's keep this informal, so ask questions as I go along. So I hope there's a lot of questions as we go. I'll go slow. I don't have that much material to cover, and I want to keep this very non-technical, so ask lots of questions. Okay, this is my main slide I have for this talk, and I'll spend a lot of time talking about this. And the idea is that I start from very small gases and aerosols and go to the end result here, which is precipitation on the ground that you measure in the rain gauge. So the idea of enhancing precipitation is that we want to get more precipitation falling on the ground. So that's the end goal. So keep this in mind as what we want to get to. Okay. And it occurs naturally, but when you're trying to enhance precipitation, we're going to try to change that process or enhance it, make it more efficient. And that's why I have all these steps back here, because generally what we do is to get more precipitation, we change the aerosols. Either put hydroscopic aerosols for base seeding into the cloud, or put AGI aerosols in. So we start up here where we're changing the aerosol spectrum. So this is what we try to do with our seeding. This is what we're trying to get out. So I want to not go in too much depth into the complicated process of this, but I want to focus on the measurements that we make along the way and what we can measure in the process of going in from the aerosol spectrum down to the precipitation. Try to give you a general overview. So we'll back up one step. So I said that we try to induce aerosols, either hydroscopic or AGI aerosols in there. But let's back up one step and think about where does the naturally occurring aerosols come from. Okay, what generates them here in this region?
What's the source?
Yeah, what's the source of the aerosols that are here? So, anybody want to tell me what the sources are for the aerosols and how they change? Yeah?
We have two types of source, nitrile and dextrose. So, dextrose, I think, comes from the human activity and thermogenic, like this function.
Yeah?
And the other issue for the nitrile from the desert and from the ocean.
What about, do you think there's nothing else besides the desert and the ocean? So, in terms of I guess maybe you say the desert, is that, when you say desert, does that mean there's all the land, or, so it's either land or the ocean. So you say it's all surface The source is at the surface. Okay, can it change in the atmosphere? Yes? So it can change in the atmosphere. Can it be created in the atmosphere?
Yeah, right.
So it can be created in the atmosphere too. So the source is not just on the surface, particularly. So how can they be created in the atmosphere? Would the aerosol particles be created in the atmosphere?
Actually, I don't know, but I think they are a limit for the aerosols. It depends about the diameter and the size of this.
Okay, so let's talk. I'll step back and tell you the answer a little bit. One way that they can get created is by gases like sulfur dioxide, nitrate, ammonia, sulfur dioxide, ammonia gases are in the atmosphere. You get high concentrations, you get some sunlight, and it will either create new particles by creating new very small 3 to 10 nanometer particles out of the gas phase. Is one method, or you can have gases that condense onto existing particles. Okay, so one thing that you'll notice here, if you ever look at the data, I was just looking at this for the last couple of flights, is we take off at the surface here, we go out, we fly around for 2 or 3 hours, we come back and land. Typically, always when we land, the aerosol concentrations are higher. So why is that?
I think because the size, the type of the aerosols and the size is, it is the effect for the concentration, the higher concentration near the ground. Because a big size near the ground cannot to go up for high level. I think that's my
opinion. And also the time of takeoff and landing.
Yeah, the time. So we usually, let's go back to the time. So I heard something. We got the time of takeoff and landing.
Yeah, right.
So typically when we take off, it's earlier in the afternoon.
Yes.
And then when we land, it's later in the day. So typically we'll take off somewhere between, say, noon and 2. And then we ran between 4 and 5 or 6. So there's a change with the time of day.
Yes.
So yeah, I heard yes, of course. So why? I mean, okay, I'm.
The sun.
So yeah, it has something to do with the sun, because you got the sun up there shining. So what's it doing?
I think it just depends on radiation comes from the sun, and the emission absorbed from the air.
Yeah.
Emitted all the radiation in the night, and I think this two issue can affect for this.
Okay.
So high concentration in the ground at this time.
Yeah. So when you say something from the surface, let's pin this down a little bit. I measure gas concentrations. So the idea is you have sunlight and high, let's say, sulfur dioxide. So the theory is that sulfur dioxide gas will either condense to form new particles or condense onto existing particles and grow them bigger. So if you have an instrument like a DMA or PCASP that measures just at one size, and you have these particles sitting out there in the sun, they got these gases condensing onto them, they're getting bigger. So you'll see more particles. And then at night, when the sun goes down, you don't have this reaction. You don't have the gases condensing. So as an aside, where would this be an extreme case? Where could you go on the Earth where you have very little sunlight for, I heard something back, the poles. So if you go to the poles, particularly the northern poles, they've done a lot of research up there, you can get, it's dark all the time, all day long, for many months out of the year. Then you have these gases that are emitted down lower, they correct up there. Then you got the sunlight come up, and you got this big increase in the aerosols. You know, that's a more of a major buildup because you have these photochemical reactions. So the idea is we have gas analyzers on board the aircraft to measure what the gas concentration is so that we know, so that we can help determine how much of this gas to particle conversion is going on. Do you have high sulfur dioxide emissions here? Do you have high concentrations of pollutants that would be associated with particle or with gases that would condense onto particles? So that's one question that we can address here is, you know, how much would you expect it to grow? And then also, how much of this is natural and how much is anthropogenic? You know, some of it, like carbon monoxide, we got a carbon monoxide analyzer on there, which is a good tracer for pollution from vehicle exhaust, from burning, from combustion processes. So that's one case. I also have transport. So a lot of times, particularly in larger aerosols, the dust aerosols, if it's not created here, it can be transported. You know, either from a dusty desert region or maybe a big, large city could transport some aerosols into your region. So how do you look at transport? And what I have underneath here, I have the instruments that's associated with it. So I put on here aircraft and satellites. We can do transects along the aircraft to look. We fly at one altitude, low down, and see if we fly into the wind to see is it higher upwind than it is downwind of a city, of a region, to see if there's a prevalent transport of aerosols from one region to the other. So that's one thing. We can do this with satellites if we get good satellite data on like the dust. When you look at the maps, you see the dusty regions in some extent.
Well, we can use the modeling and do like trajectory.
Yep. So you can do modeling, you can look at back trajectories, look for where that air mass came from. Did it come from, over the desert? Did it come from over the sea? And stuff like that. So that's a very good analysis tool too. I'm focusing more on the instruments, so. But there's stuff like models, back trajectories that also play into this. So while I'll focus just on the instruments on this talk, there's more that goes into it. To bring in the models, to bring in some more conceptual stuff, to bring in some more satellite data would also be helpful. So that gives us basically our background aerosol. So we get this aerosol that's in here naturally. Okay, and we got two primary instruments to measure that. We got a DMA, which stands for Differential Mobility Analyzer. This is one of the instruments kind of in the back of the aircraft. I'll show you some pictures later on. And we got a PCAS. The DMA measures up to, what does it measure up to? 0.5 microns, I believe. It starts at 10 nanometers, so it's a small size aerosol. From 10 nanometers up to, let's say, 500 nanometers. The PCAS starts at 100 nanometers and goes up to 3,000. A nanometer is 10 to the minus 9th. A lot of times I'll talk in microns. So the For example, PCAS measures from 0.1 microns up to 3 microns. So these will tell us what the background aerosols are here, so that when we introduce, when we go and burn our AGIs, or we burn our burn and trace hygroscopic flares, we know what we're putting. We're putting in these aerosols into an existing environment. And how effective them aerosols are depends on what's there to begin with. You know, if naturally you have the same things like AGI, you know, as silver iodine. If there's a lot of material in the air that's already like silver iodine, well, adding a little bit more is not going to make a big difference. But if there's very little silver iodine in the atmosphere, add in a little bit more will greatly change the aerosols that are there. So we have to know what is there to begin with so we can have an idea of what we do to change it. Okay, so I got through the first line. Any questions? So now we know what the aerosols are and the background aerosols. And that's not enough because we want to know what effect these aerosols have on crowds. Because we're interested in this case in precipitation. There's other reasons to be interested in aerosols that I won't talk about. But in our case, we want to get to precipitation. So this known aerosol spectrum is the most important thing to know. Secondary to that, and in some cases almost equally important, is the aerosol chemistry. Okay? Do you have a lot of aerosols that are hydroscopic? That means they like to take up water for the crowd particles to condense onto. That depends on the characteristic of the aerosol, basically the chemical composition of the aerosols. So we want to know what type of aerosols, because what we want to get to is what we call a condensation nuclei spectrum, CCN spectrum. So if we know this, and we know the chemistry, we can predict what this is. So most of these things I have, if you know the gas concentration, you know the transport, you can predict what the aerosol spectrum is. There's some assumptions you have to make along the way. However, these are the major important things. These are what you have to focus on. So there's a lot of tangential, a lot of things that you can think about that might make a difference. But I want to focus just on the major stuff. So if we measure the aerosol spectrum, we know the chemistry, we can predict the CCN spectrum. Okay, and we have instruments that measure all three of these. I already talked about the DMA and PCAS. We have a filter pack on the aircraft. And what that does is brings air in while we're flying and deposits it on a filter. And then we send these filters off to be analyzed. Okay, and that tells us something about the chemistry of the aerosols. You look at individual particles, you count them up, you see what chemical composition these particles are. You can't do it in, I shouldn't say you can't do it. It's very difficult to do it in real time. You know, there's very expensive instruments to try to get aerosol chemistry in real time. But there's only a couple of them in the world. It takes very complicated instrument to do that. So we get the CCN spectrum, and what that is, these are the particles that water will condense on to form cloud droplets. So this is the first part of getting precipitation. You got to form a cloud droplet. And part of what I'm doing here is I'm working with two cloud condensation nuclei counters to make sure they're working right. And we have two different counters that measure this on the aircraft right now, because it's a very important measurement. Okay, I'll stop there. Any questions? Understand what a a CCN is. Basically, this counter, what it does is it simulates the environment of a crowd. It basically mates it with a crowd inside the instrument and sees how many droplets form. And then you can find this. You change the supersaturation. You change the amount of water that you're condensing onto the particles, or the driving force that basically condenses the water vapor onto the aerosol particles by changing this, the supersaturation. So when I mean CCN spectrum, I mean changes in supersaturation. Okay, so for our crowds, if you have the aerosol spectrum, we know the updraft, we know how much moisture is there. This is kind of, you need a little bit more moisture to make what you call a droplet spectrum. Here I'm talking about what happens in a real crowd. Is you have some air, it's at 100% humidity, you have your crowd base, and you lift that parcel up. When you lift it, what important thing happens? Why do crowds form? Water condenses. So why does water condense in crowds high in the atmosphere as compared to on the surface? Okay, temperature. So what's different in temperature? It's lower up high. So why? Well, I'll ask the meteorologist in here. Why is the temperature lower higher in the atmosphere than at the surface?
Talk about the temperature?
So I'm talking about the temperature. Yeah. So why is it warmer at the surface than it is at 10,000 feet? Or why is it colder up here at 7,000 feet than it is down at the Red Sea? I'll let any... Go ahead. So why?
Well, there's heating on the ground, and there's also higher pressure down here.
Okay. So there's heating at the ground.
The radiation is effect of the surface, and the earth absorbed all the temperature with coming from the sun.
Yeah. So the sunlight is the source of the energy.
Yeah.
Okay, so where is that sunlight absorbed? Is it absorbed in the atmosphere, or is it absorbed at the surface?
Well, in general, from the atmosphere and the surface, absorbs the temperature.
So which one absorbs more?
Or particles or absorbed in the atmosphere suspended. These particles emitted and scattered and absorbed and emission all the radiation.
Yeah, But the sunlight that comes in, where is it absorbed the most?
The surface.
Yeah. So it's absorbed at the surface.
Yes.
But this doesn't necessarily have to be the case.
Because the earth, like body.
Yeah. Because the black body emits.
Emits all the radiation. Absorb it.
And re-emits it. But there's a balance between the absorption and the emission.
Right.
So the question is, why? Let's change the case. Let's look at water. I was happened to go swimming in the Red Sea about a week ago. And when you swim in the ocean, the top of the ocean is warm.
Yeah, right.
You go down, it's cold. So the bottom is not warm in the ocean, but the bottom of the atmosphere is warm.
It's they're away from the point of absorption from the sun.
Okay.
So in relation to the atmosphere, the further away from the radiation point, which is the land, the less heat gets to that level.
So you would just say, okay, the top of the ocean is closer to the sun, so then it should be warmer.
No. The top of the sun.
Yeah.
And then the heat radiates out, but obviously it loses its energy as it goes.
Okay.
The deeper you go, the less energy is coming from that point.
So why does the top of the ocean absorb the sunlight and not the top of the atmosphere?
Because it's got a better, it holds heat better.
Well, heat content, I mean, the water's all the same, so it's going to have the same heat content. So you're going to have it. But the key point to remember is that the sunlight comes in particular wavelengths of light.
Long wave.
There's long wave, short wave, and visible light. So you got visible light, you got short wavelength, you got long wavelength. So actually the short wavelength is absorbed in the stratosphere by ozone. So if you go really high, here maybe 50,000 feet and above, it will increase. Okay? The top of the tropopause, generally where the airliners fly, is the coldest part of the atmosphere, or at least of the lower atmosphere. So if you're up higher, the shortwave energy is absorbed by ozone that's up there. However, the sunlight that's at the visible part of the spectrum goes right through that. So it penetrates through that ozone. And it penetrates through the atmosphere and hits the surface. So most of the sunlight that comes in, because the sun produces light at a particular wavelength, because of the temperature of the sun. And that wavelength goes through the atmosphere and heats the surface of the atmosphere of the Earth. But it doesn't go through the water. It's absorbed in the water. That's why it's warmer at the surface of the water. So it's all about where the sunlight is absorbed, or basically where that light is changed into temperature. And it's very important by the type of gas molecules that are in the atmosphere that does that. So this is a long way of saying that the atmosphere is heated basically from the surface, for what we care about. It's heated from the surface, gets colder as you go up. If you rise humid air up, you get some updrafts here. You have a moisture, so you have some water and water vapor, and you'll condense and form clouds once it gets cold enough. So we have the CCN cone to measure the aerosols. We have the Ames probe on the aircraft to measure in this case, very important to measure the updraft. We can ask the pilots how much updraft they're feeling from the aircraft. We have dew point to know how dry it is. I mean, if it's really dry, you rift it, you really got to rift it a long ways to get crowds to form. You know, that's the difference between your high cirrus crowds and your lower level crowds. It's how high you have to rift it, how moist it is. It's like every morning you do the sound and you always want to look where that dew point is. So we have instruments to measure that. And then we form a cloud out there. And we have an instrument called an FSSP to measure that cloud. Okay, if you know this, you know the updraft, you know there's enough moisture, you can predict the droplet spectrum.
Droplet spectrum. Why you say this droplet spectrum? Why you didn't say like cloud formation like this? If all this parameter presents here, we can get clouds.
Mm-hmm.
Like
usually.
You talk about droplets.
Yes. So in this case, a lot of times I say cloud droplet spectrum. Usually I use the term droplet to refer to small cloud particles. So these are droplets that are typically 3 to 20 microns. When I talk droplets, I mean small cloud droplets. Okay, to differentiate between drops or precipitation rain drops. So droplet means small drop. So yeah, please ask the terminology. And some people sometimes mix their terminology. So you gotta be careful. Even back in the old literature, sometimes the CCN spectrum we refer to as a CN spectrum. And you look back 30 years ago and they call it something different. And you're like, what were they thinking back then? You know, I mean, so terminology does evolve too. But basically we can do this, if we measure this and this, we can determine what this is. And basically the idea is this has a large influence on the cloud droplet spectrum. The same thing that aerosol spectrum has a lot of influence on the CCN spectrum. Okay. So now we have some droplets, some instability. We can get bigger clouds to form, get some drizzle. This is a natural process. Get some drizzle to form, which is, when I say drizzle, I mean 20, 25 microns, larger droplets in there. Start get the droplets to form. You typically need some drizzle, some larger droplets to start and form some very large droplets in the cloud, some really large drops to get the warm rain coalescence, warm rain process going. So you get, and it only takes a few of these. So the magic thing here is that you get one large drop in the cloud. And if it's large enough, it will fall. So here's another question that I talk to kids about. So you got these, you know, if you look at the nice puffy small clouds in the atmosphere, why do they stay up in the sky? They're liquid droplets of water, you know. So these small droplets, why do they stay there? Why don't they fall to the ground?
Updraft.
Okay. So if there's an updraft, well, let's assume that the cloud formed, there was an updraft, and the updraft disappeared. Mm-hmm. Well, the cloud didn't descend?
No.
Well, would it just stay right at the same level?
Well, it'll stay there.
Okay, so you know it stays there because you've seen them stay there. I mean, you fly underneath them, there's not much updraft, but the cloud stay there.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Okay, so Jared's almost right. He said that it has to do with the size of the droplets. So if you had a 10 micrometer droplet, it's not very heavy. So the idea is that, I like to think of it, is that it's not that they don't fall, it's just that they fall very, very slowly. And you can calculate how long it would take a cloud to fall to the surface. If you're up there and say it's 4 kilometers above the surface, it takes days for it to fall to the ground. Okay? So without any updrafts, you got some turbulence and some other things, but if you didn't have all that turbulence, updrafts, the clouds would still fall, but very slowly, and they'll be long gone before you notice them falling. So we want to get the water, now that we took in this water vapor, condensed it high up in the atmosphere, okay, but we want it at the surface. So to get it down, you got to get big drops. Okay, and so that's what you want to get with the drizzle. You get some of these bigger droplets, they begin to fall through the cloud. Okay, so if you get some bigger droplets, particularly higher up in the cloud, they fall, or it's all these small droplets that they collide with. Okay, so you got a droplet, it falls, you got another small droplet, and it impacts on it. So they collide, and they coalesce. The coalescence means they join together. And you get it with a bigger droplet. So then it starts to fall faster. Once you get this process going, you can get bigger and bigger droplets to form. So the idea of the hygroscopic seeding is we want to introduce the right aerosols to get drizzle to form, to get some really large droplets to form in that crowd. And the thing is, you don't need very many of these. Okay? You just need to get the process going. Because you take a few of them, they'll correct a lot, you get a lot of raindrops. Let's see, we got rain, we got humidity profiles. You can get rain to start falling out of the crowd, but we want precipitation at the surface. So, you know, that depends how dry it is. Does it evaporate on the way down? So you can measure that with your profiles, and then you use rain gauges typically to measure at the surface. So you can use the radars to measure precipitation in the crowds, but it won't see the ground. So that's why you need the rain gauges. So I won't talk too much about this last part, but here it can be important to see if it's actually hitting the ground. So to go back to the whole idea is that there's two ways to get the precipitation to form. There's a warm rain process, and there's an ice or cold rain process when you have ice phases in the crowds. So the whole idea is we'll try to introduce hygroscopic flares to get more drizzle to form, and we induce AGI flares to get ice to form in the crowds. Okay? And what we're trying to do here is understand this whole process in terms of the conditions here. Okay? With a couple of objectives. One is to try to come up with, okay, which is the best method theoretically to work. Okay? Also understand how it does work in detail so that we can come up with maybe improved methods, the conditions under which it will work, and maybe it won't work in all conditions. You know, what are them conditions where it will work the best?
So you talk about the methodology, like the methodology for how can we measure and define and plan and whatever, improve and control for, plan.
Yeah, yes. So the question is, I think you're asking, is part of what we're trying to do is to figure out better methodologies, better ways to enhance the precipitation. And that is the case. What the scientists here are trying to do is to optimize, to make it most effective, most efficient. So that's the whole way I like to look at this, is we're trying to make the precipitation process more efficient. So it's like a factory or something where you run and you want to, you know, make a car, make some end product. Well, you want to do that most cost-effectively, most efficient. Use your labor, your resources the most efficiently as possible. So, and for example, if we have, just for one case, we have hygroscopic flares we can use, we got AGI flares. Okay? Typically, if you got an aircraft out there, they can only do one at a time. Which one is better? You know. That depends on the environment. Depends on what's here. And you can have a theoretical understanding. Well, this one should be better. That's one way to look at it. But you also want to improve your theoretical understanding because no one really fully understands how this whole process works in all cases. So if you fully understood this, you could put it into a model and you could say, okay, we got this day, we got this condition, okay, we get the pyrites, they put the material in the right spot, we should get this result. You know, if you can get to that point, you feel a lot more confident that you know what you're doing. You know, there's a lot of theory behind what we do here, and it's the best theory we have. But some environments are more challenging than the others. From what I've seen, this is a pretty challenging environment. So just because hydroscopic seeding or AGI seeding worked in one environment doesn't mean it's going to work in a different one, because the background aerosols are different. You know, for example, the chemistry of the aerosols may be different. So that's one of the things I'm interested in doing in here, is to understand this process and make it most efficient. And if you ask, I mean, that's the whole idea of what you're trying to do, is you want to increase this, okay? We're making the process back here more efficient by adding a little bit of aerosols to go through all this. So I can almost do a whole lecture on one slide. I proved it now. What's this one slide a minute stuff? So that's kind of, I'm trying to give a kind of a big picture, but not a huge big picture. Just the picture about the instruments. And you see here, we have instruments, FSSP, 2DC, for measuring each one of these. And then someone could ask, maybe someone should ask, well, you know, if you know this and you know this and you can predict this, well, why do we have to measure all of them? You know, can we really predict all these things? And sometimes the instrumentation is not quite good enough. You know, a lot of times, you know, it's nice to have multiple measurements that confirm our theory. If, for example, we'll go out there, and one of the things I've done in Maui and other places, and I'll do for here, is we look at what the crowd dropper spectrum is. Okay? If you can have higher crowd dropper spectrums, you would think that you would have higher CCN concentrations from a first approximation. Other things could be changed, like updraft, but the first thing we look at is the CCN. This is higher, you would expect the dropper spectrum to be higher. Now, before I go on, I talked about the instruments. I want to do one more thing, but I'll pause, see if there's any questions. Okay, no one's raising their hands. Okay, so we want to study this whole process. Okay? And we want to know from the aerosol spectrum to the precipitation. We want to understand that process fully. Now, in my opinion, there's two ways to do this. And I tell you about the one that you think about the, at least that comes to my mind first, in most people's mind first, is that let's go out and we'll take a case. We'll take one day, we'll go out there, we'll measure each one of these parameters, okay, all the way through the system. We'll measure the aerosols, we'll measure the chemistry, we'll measure the CCN, we'll measure everything, and we'll make a model of that case. Okay? And see if we understand how things go from one of these cases, from one line to the next. Okay, in this particular case. Okay, and then we'll do it for another case because things may be a little bit different. So, can someone tell me some of the problems associated with trying to do that? Of trying to measure these parameters for one case.
And you might not have all the weather you need. I mean, it might be stopped at one, you know, one level, and you might not have crystals.
You might not get precipitation out of all cases. So you might not have the full developed system. What happens, though, if, heaven forbids or something, we got traffic in the way? Okay, we designed to go up there, we measure the aerosols right away, but we get a little bit delayed. Okay, and we missed the first one. Well, then what do? We start over, say, oh, that day is no good, because we didn't get the measurements at the beginning. So I'm thinking more logistically here. Maybe the pilots can help me out. I mean, to go through and make all the measurements with an aircraft, and particularly when we're thinking about we need to measure aerosols underneath the clouds, we need to measure the clouds, we need to measure drizzle. Okay, these are in different parts of the clouds. It takes time, too, for these things to evolve. So we're up there, we got limited fuel. We can only measure at one location in the crowd. And sometimes it's high. If you want to be, you know, looking at the tops of the crowds and then knowing if there's precip coming out the bottom, well, you can't be measuring both with the aircraft. So we can only measure at a point in at one time. Each one of these probes are on the aircraft, so you're only measuring in the vicinity of the aircraft. So we try to do that. We try to look for the whole case to go through here. So now my question is if you want to study this process, and instead of doing it by looking at one case and following that whole case through, how else would you do it? How else could you do it? And I'll give you a hint. What do astronomers do for studying stars? You know, if you look at the stars in the sky, they want to study the stars. And they want to look at the evolution of a star from being a small planetary nebula, forming a protostar, forming a star. That star eventually grows, burns out its fuels, dies, makes a supernova remnant, and dies. Or if a doctor or someone wants to study people, you want to study the life cycle of a person. You got infants, you got young children, you got old children, you got middle age, they get old, they die. So you want to study, you know, for a person, maybe that only takes 100 years. Okay? For a star, it can take billions of years. So if you had one case, and you started and you looked at that one case, you look at one case, you follow someone either from infants to old age, and then you'd start another one. Well, that would take you a long time to learn about people growing old or stars evolving. So how do they do it? Okay, so you have multiple. You look at multiple people. Look at multiple stars. Okay? So let's say, I like my star example. So you look at stars at different ages of their life cycle. So, you know, they've only been observing stars for, let's say, intensely with big telescopes for 100 years. Well, they've looked at them in various stages of their life.
Very period.
Yes. So what I like to do is do the same thing with the clouds. Okay? Instead of following one cloud throughout its life cycle, which may be 2 or 3 hours, we'll go and look at 100 clouds. Okay? We go up there and we measure one cloud, and it may be in the middle of its life cycle. Okay? So the idea is we'll measure a droplet spectrum here, but we'll look at the distribution of them droplets. Okay? What's the average droplet size? You know, what's the boundaries of the droplet spectrum? We'll look at the same thing with the aerosols. with the gases. You know, what's the medium? What's the average? What's the most likely? Medium is most likely to occur. What's the extreme events? Okay? And look at it statistically in terms of, you know, we know statistically what this is. We know statistically what this is. And so we don't follow any one individual case, but look at them all throughout their life cycle. So when we go up there, we make measurements. We want to target the same types of crowds. We want to target the same types of areas, but we don't necessarily have to follow the whole life cycle of one crowd. However, we got to make sure that we do look at the same types of crowds. I mean, we want to look at seeding candidates, candidates that would be good cases for seeding. Convective crowds. You don't want to go measure cirrus crowds that are high up in the atmosphere. Also, you want to look at one particular season, okay, and in one area. So for here, you can look at the Ischia region and near Apa here, and look at the crowds in Apa during the summer and say, okay, all these crowds are going to be similar. Okay, just like stars in similar conditions are going to be similar. Or maybe you can extend that to people. Okay, you can group them together in that type of sense. And that will work because if you're going to come here and do a precipitation enhancement, you want to work to the average, to the medium. And I usually say average and medium. They're kind of interchangeable, but a lot of times they're not in terms of this one. The medium is what occurs most of the time. So you want to design your program to go out there and be effective and efficient for what occurs most of the time. Realizing that, well, you may have some special cases that you have to adapt to. Okay? So I like to look at these statistically. And you can get that. You can get radars. The radars give you statistics on your rain. The aircraft measurements, we can get statistics on what the droplet spectrum is, how much drizzle is in there, how much ice. And we can compare these to other regions to see if the aerosols are higher here than other places. Okay, I've really done a whole lecture on one slide now. So I'll just show you a couple more slides I put together, and we'll go through this really quickly if there's no questions, and then we can... No question. But that's an idea. I'll just go through this, and this is more a thing for people who look at pictures. I'll go through the same thing. I'm going to look at these one at a time and show you the pictures of the instruments and then show you what they're measuring. So gas phase analyzer, the aircraft. These are rectal microscope images of small aerosol particles.
Small aerosol?
Yeah.
Particles?
Yeah, so this is 400 nanometers.
Is gas or solid, liquid?
No, these are solid.
Solid?
Yeah, so these are, I don't know, cubicles. So you see how these ones have nice square structures to them? There's small ones in here. So these are images of very small.
Different phases like square and circle?
Different types of aerosols. So like AGI, silver iodine, it works for nucleated ice because it's not circular, because it has a crystalline shape to it. Okay? So different compounds will grow in different shapes. Some grow in crystals, some grow more spherical. Okay, so now we got the DMA, we got a PCAS, we got our aerosol filters, and also you can introduce your own either with the hygroscopic flares. And you change what the aerosols occur. So you can have something like this emitted and then have gases condense onto it. Very complicated aerosols that are multiple chemical compositions in one aerosol. So very complicated chemistry. After you know, you can have primary emissions, but you can have gas condenses, you can have coagulation of aerosols. So a lot of these things can evolve in the atmosphere. And how they change. So that's what we measure with these instruments. You know, how the aerosol spectrum, in a general sense, changes. So, like I said before, you know, you can look at the distribution of aerosols at noon compared to 5 o'clock, see if there's a difference. Not in any one individual aerosol, but look at a whole bunch of them. So I think you had a question or a comment? Okay, I'm trying to. So I'm showing you some nice pictures. This is a DMT CCN counter where we make a little crowd in here. This is the Ames probe. We got a dew point sensor. And what you should see is little puffy little crowds. Not much vertical development. Maybe a couple hundred feet, maybe 500 feet. These are your first cumulus crowds to develop. First ones with small droplet spectrums in them. Just starting to condense particles. Okay, and you can talk about the life cycles of the crowds and stuff. But you get this, you get a little updraft, you get your crowds to start forming. Now we can measure, you know, with the FSSP, if you got some good humidity profiles, you can start getting more development. You know, a couple thousand feet, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 feet, you get the drizzle to start forming. You know, you can form ferroeta cumulus very easy. You need some instability. You need some, you know, cape and the profiles that you measure, which depends on your temperature humidity profiles to get bigger crowds to form. Then you can start seeing, I don't know if there's a crowd base here with a little precip coming out of it. We got a 2D C probe that measures the logic droplets. This will also tell us if there's ice in the cloud, to see how much water is there, to see what's happening inside the cloud when you start getting bigger particles to form. What you want to end up with is some precip that's coming out of the cloud and hitting the ground. We got a 2DP probe that's not on the aircraft right now that measures big precipitation size particles. You can also do this with radars. But ideally, you want rain gauges on the surface to measure what comes at the surface. So I just showed you pictures of aircraft instruments. You can put it all together, kind of see. The idea here is we have instruments that measure over 5 or 6 orders of magnitude. From stuff that's 10 nanometers in size to several millimeters in size for the precip to come out. So the idea is a big scale of ranges. And so what you want is you want to get this precip here, but we affect it at a very small scale, what we're trying to do for the trigger. So there's not one instrument that can even measure the aerosols over this whole range, much less the crowds and the composition. So that's why you need to have several instruments. Some have different advantages than others. And you put it together, and you can see the life cycle of the crowd systems and the aerosols that go with it. And understand it in one case of how to do it. Okay, a couple conclusions. I just said the first one, 5 orders of magnitude. And the idea is we want to have a lot of advanced scientific instruments to measure these. It's not easy, and we're improving the instrumentation all the time. For example, the Ames probe is the first time we were measuring updraft velocity with an Ames probe on here, because updraft is an important quantity. But I'm not convinced that, for example, the Ames probe is the best, how well that's working. We might need even more advanced instrumentation in terms of updraft velocity. The crowd droplet spectrum, we want to measure it faster and understand it. And it's got to be driven by, well, I shouldn't say it has to be. My thinking is in a case like this, we want to drive it by the desire to understand and to enhance precipitation. So there's a clear motivating factor here, you know, that, you know, it's not the idea that, well, I'm a scientist, I know this instrument, oh, let's just put it on here. I mean, there's a lot of instruments I know about that I haven't talked about. You know, there's a lot of different aerosol instruments, crowd instruments, that are available, but we don't have them because we're focusing on understanding precipitation in this area and how to enhance it. So the idea is you want to keep the goal, the objective in mind, and design what measurements you need to understand that and to reach that goal of understanding the precip, how it forms, and how most effectively and efficiently to do it. Okay? And if one method doesn't work, or if you're not applying the method correctly, you know, you can have zero results. Okay? You want to make sure that you get rid of that and move to something that has a chance to work or that's proven to work. Okay? And every area is different. There's not a canned routine where you do X, Y, Z and it will work in every area. It's still kind of immature in that sense. So, good opportunity. Questions? I spent probably far too much time on this, but I wanted to try to give that overview because I don't think we've discussed this before. Some of this is obvious to some of us, but even the idea of how to study this, should you do case studies, should you do statistics, ideally we do both. You get really good case studies, you do a couple of them, you look and when you get them really good jewels of having a really good day and being able to measure everything you need, then you look at that and see what you can learn. But I think there's a lot of value in doing the statistics. So, is this helpful?
Yeah, thanks. That was really informative. Yeah,
I wish I had more pirates here. I should. I know this is too early. I interrupted their lunch and stuff. So, but that's kind of the science, the broad overview. I mean, obviously, I could tell you all the equations that we use and all the models and how we calibrate the instruments, but that's not really for the general, that's more for what I do. You know, for the pilots, I think this is good to know the general process to help out and what we're trying to do in a general sense. And, you know, again, it's going to be pilots that have to understand how to target these crowds. You know, we can hopefully what we come up with is some guidelines to say, okay, do this, and have it so that you can, you know, you can pick it up relatively quickly. Is that, you know, this is the, you know, here's like I don't want to say a manual, but kind of an outline of what should happen. And we have that to some extent, but it's going to be different in this region. So, you know, hopefully, you know, people like Roger and stuff, they, you know, got a lot of experience doing this, which helps a lot. But to kind of jumpstart that experience, you know, you get some theoretical understanding, I think, helps. And that's one reason why the scientists are here, is to try to jumpstart that theoretical understanding and to see, you know, is this typical? You know, is this a typical case? Which you get with experience, but hopefully we can jumpstart it so it doesn't take 20 years or something to get that experience. But you can't do this type of work or theoretically either. You got to get out there and look at the crowds and see what they are. That's why this is, you know, very hands-on type of things. People that just do computer models, they don't do this work. And you can't remodel it yet, so Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.